Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights, and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability, to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal, $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Coming to a screen near you, a language and etymology podcast critics are calling absolutely fine. Rob Watts and Jesse Ferris star in a cinema and filmcraft edition of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Ferris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell. And today we are rolling out the red carpet and we are talking about movies, film, and TV. Isn't that right?
Yes, lights, camera, action. It's everything to do with the silver screen and whatever the television equivalent of that is.
Fabulous.
Nailed that. Good. So where do we start with this one, Jess?
I think we should start with the basics. Like, we've got some cool words here. I mean, it took me like way too long in life to like really connect the dots that like the word movie is just named for things that move. And yeah. Like, which is wild because I understood that that's what talkie meant, yeah. Like in film history.
Yeah, it is the next step.
But I was like 10 before I was like, oh yeah, a movie is named because it moves.
Yeah. So you had talking pictures and then you had moving pictures, and movie is a shortening of the phrase moving pictures. And also motion pictures is around about the same time. You've got that too. Whereas in England, we're generally still calling it a film rather than a movie. If you say movie, you sound a little pretentious, a bit like you're a bit too into it, to be honest.
Oh, so you sound like a Hollywood hustler or something like that.
yeah. Really, the words film and movie, in terms of their age, could not be more different, because movie, you know, is barely a century old, only a little bit more than a century old, whereas the word film, you can trace back as long as the English language has existed, which I think is quite surprising, actually.
It's like any membrane, right? Like anything has a film on it.
That's right. You have the old English filmine, which, yes, it could be a membrane or a tissue of a plant or an animal. It did also have another meaning, Jess, that I'm not going to spend too much time on. But it did very specifically mean foreskin as well.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah. I have before me an old English description of circumcision, and there it is.
Fabulous.
Anyway, moving on. Do we need to explain why we say something different in Britain to in America? I mean, it's kind of hard to explain precisely why that happens other than just sort of habit.
I think it's just different industry terms, right? I mean, because like the British film industry and the Hollywood West Coast film industry have rose up not contemporaneously, but close enough, and it had so much in common, but also had their own lingo and jargon, which we'll get into a lot of the jargon.
Yeah, and I think people will be surprised by how much of the jargon actually is British, because I was surprised to find out how much of it was.
Oh, I'm interested to see how we differ too. Another cool one before we move on from the basics, I just like the notion of cinematography is kind of beautiful as a spin-off of photography. Photography is drawing with light, literally, given its Greek elements. And so cinematography is drawing with movement.
Yeah. And did you know that an early term alternative to cinema was the more Greek inspired? So it's kinema. It looks like kinema. It's spelled same as cinema with a K, but it's pronounced kinema.
Ooh.
And that was just as commonly used as the word cinema in the early days of cinema, and actually links it to a lot of other words for cinema. Like here in Germany, it's Kino, right? Which is a cute way of saying basically the same thing.
That sounds to me like a mythical creature of some kind.
Yeah, doesn't it? The kinema.
Little chimera, you know?
Actually, that reminds me of the Chiron, which is something that we should come to a little bit later. Televisual industry term. Television. We're going to cover some television as well. This falls under one of your pet hates, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well, see, I love them, but a lot of people don't like them. It is a hybrid word because it combines the Greek tele, meaning far, and the Latin vision, meaning seeing.
It means far seer. What I think is most interesting about the word television is that it is older than the television.
Right.
So there are mentionings of the idea of a television. So in 1900, they've already got the telephone, but they're talking about one day we'll have this television and we'll be able to see each other as if we were in the same room. And then the television, as we know, the first live televisual broadcast doesn't happen until the mid-1920s. John Logie Baird credited with it, so building on other people's works, but absolutely there. And he called his machine the televisor rather than the television, but it is the television that catches on.
Early in this same period, like pre-television, other proposed names for a similar technology were the telephote and the televista, which we still see vista in a lot of like movie and TV terms and brands.
It's all about seeing things, isn't it?
I'm sure you've heard of the network called the Nickelodeon, right?
I have. Yeah. Yes. It was one of those channels that you had to pay for on UK cable, and my parents were never willing to. So I was always very jealous of all my friends who had Cartoon Network and Nickelodeon available to them.
One of my favorite aspects of film history is the original Nickelodeon, which I'm sure you're familiar with. It's a place where you can go see films for a nickel. The last little bit is a Greek element, meaning like a roofed over theater. So it was a theater where you could pay a nickel.
We still have Odeon branded cinemas.
Right. It's all of these are modeled after a Paris music hall called the Odeon. And then there were dime museums called Melodeons. There was like a music hall with that name in Boston. So it's fun to look up old photos of Nickelodeons because they were both opulent and kind of accessible at the same time.
There's some fun old words for movies as well that didn't catch on that I should mention. They were known as living pictures, animatographs, picture plays, photodramas, bioscopes, which was a word that really caught on in South Africa. It's a bit antiquated now, but yeah, bioscopes was a word over there. Flicks. My grandma used to call them the flicks. She used to say she was going to the flicks, which I always think so. I mean, you know, you still sometimes hear the word flick used.
We still get it in Netflix.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, precisely. Right. And finally, moon pitcher, which is M-O-O-M. Pitcher, like
moon, okay.
Yeah, like a, you know, like a glass jug pitcher. Yeah, moon pitcher, which is obviously just a cute way of saying motion picture.
You said animatograph.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever came up with that one was so proud of it and so mad that it didn't take off, I guarantee it.
We shall call it the animatograph.
So good.
Because they're getting exactly the same idea, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Drawing the movement, but nope. Not this time.
Speaking of which, do you know why we call cartoons cartoons?
No, I don't.
It's named after heavy paper or pasteboard on which the preliminary sketches for artwork were made. And obviously, cartoons don't have to move.
Right.
Political cartoons and caricatures are much older than moving cartoons. But it was applied to animation around 1916. Though before that, it was probably Punch that popularized the word cartoon in reference to editorial drawings. But animation as we think of it today began with either the invention of the magic lantern or with the development of the camera obscura, which this was this little pinhole camera. And the animation pioneer and newspaper cartoonist Winsor McCay led people to apply the word cartoon to these early animated films. He made the famous 1911 film Little Nemo in 1911 and Gertie the Dinosaur in 1914, which you can still watch.
I like the sound of Gertie the Dinosaur.
It's very cute.
It's a dinosaur film I've not seen.
Yeah, exactly.
Had the Zoe trope as well, which was that spinny thing that's usually just a horse galloping round and round and round. Yeah. Zoe trope. That's another, also derived from a word meaning movement, right? They really, really, really tried out all of the possibilities, didn't they, with this one?
We sure did.
One of these cinemas might be showing a blockbuster. Can I take us to the origin of that term?
Let's do it.
So a blockbuster is a literal thing. It's a World War II bomb used by the British. There's a quote from 1942. Several hundred of Britain's Lancasters and Halifaxes pounded Berlin with blockbusters, the two-ton bombs which shatter a city block.
That is much worse.
Yeah. But immediately... And in a way that to me strikes me as sort of bad taste, but this is in the depths of the Second World War, and I suppose there's a sort of dark humor to it, but it's immediately used to hyperbolically refer to something that is a smash, a success, right? In 1942, you can see the annual report can be a blockbuster, but frequently is a dud. And then the first film to be called a blockbuster is a film called Bombardier.
That's nicely serendipitous.
Yeah, well, is it serendipity or is it a nice bit of creative writing? And I suspect that's what it is. It's a deliberate punning on this new bomb that they're dropping over Germany, but then it catches on as a term for a film or a creative work that performs really well.
That's fabulous.
I group that word with barnstormer, which also came up when I was looking through a book of... Victorian slang, as one often it is, in the theatrical section. I don't know if you know what a barnstormer, the original barnstormers did.
No, actually, I don't. I mean, I've heard the term and in other contexts, but always metaphorical.
So the barn is real. And the barnstormers are actors, touring actors, who would, you know, arrive in very small communities and often would be performing in a barn. You know, they would have to rearrange the whole barn and hooray, they've got a stage. And that word comes to mean... Yeah, a second-rate actor, because I guess they're not sending their best people on tour necessarily, usually a sort of over-dramatic actor. But it also starts to mean other touring groups, like politicians get called barnstormers, as you know, as they go and give their stump speeches around an area. You can have musicians who are barnstormers, sports teams who are barnstormers, or even there's a type of barnstormer that is a pilot who travels around giving... informal displays.
So
they were called the barnstormers.
Interesting. So this all does ring a bell now that you're saying it. I'm like, oh yeah, of course that's what that is, because like you can still go to like local impromptu concerts and performances hosted in a barn. The latter version of that, the barnstormer as a pilot, is interesting because there is a roller coaster, a kiddie coaster at Disney World called the Barnstormer, and in it Goofy flies around in a plane that crashes into things. I'm a big roller coaster enthusiast, so I'm happy to break down any of the more famous ones sometime.
Okay. Now?
No. We should stick to movies now.
I do want to, but let's... Okay, we'll stick to movies. Yeah, barnstormer is an American term originally, so... And it is much... all of this extra currency, it doesn't really happen like that in Britain. You have the actors called that, but you don't have these other people called barnstormers, really.
This... brings up a notion, I think, too, that like the idea of barnstormers being like lower grade actors, the film industry wasn't considered high art in its early days. Like it was kind of looked down on. It took a while for it to be a respected art form. And some of the earliest silent films in particular were what we call melodramas, right? Which are dramatically older than cinema, but it was because you could view and understand the story of the movement without any of the words or with just the little like quotey title cards in between. And melodrama means like music plus action.
Ah, so it's a, I actually didn't realize that's a portmanteau on melody and drama.
You could argue that it's straight from the Greek element or, you know, but
oh,
yes.
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. No, I didn't pick up on that at all.
But yeah, melodramas have existed since like the 1700s. So
yeah, indeed.
It just means you added music over the top of the performance.
Yeah, we've got other terms that carry over into modern day television and film from obviously historic theater. Another good one is corpsing. You know, when an actor starts laughing.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that term has been around for an awfully long time. It was in the same Victorian slang book that I mentioned a few minutes ago. And why is it a corpse? Well, I mean, you can imagine that a corpse laughing is about, you know, the least appropriate person that could be laughing. But the term does not originate in the idea of an actor laughing. It's just the idea of an actor coming out of character, breaking character, particularly in a way that disturbs the other actors. And a really bad thing, really selfish thing to do. And it particularly, you know, it refers to a corpse doing that, you know, someone playing a dead body to do that. But then it means anyone that breaks character. And now it's actually so after broadening, it's sort of narrowed now. And we only really talk about corpsing as being when someone laughs. But historically, it would be anyone who like just, you know, forgot their lines or did anything or just suddenly sneezed or something. That would be a corpse. You don't want a corpse sneezing on stage either.
Right. The more intentional version of that, you might say, is breaking the fourth wall, which is also from theater too, right?
Oh,
the fourth wall being, you know,
the
barrier
is.
Between, the imaginary barrier that hides the audience behind it.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, sort of postmodern ideas aren't so modern after all.
What other movie terms do you have?
Well, I've got another one that comes from British slang from a long time back, really long time back, actually. Gaffer, you know, the gaffer,
yeah.
Which is, I think, usually like the lead engineer on a set, if I'm not incorrect, often in the lighting department, I think. But that word goes way, way back. Actually, Shakespeare uses the word gaffer. He put it in front of a description of someone. So he says a gaffer vicar, but you could have, you know, a gaffer whatever. And it means a senior sort of to be respected form or whatever you've affixed the word gaffer to. It's one step down from a master. So if this person is senior, but you know, not someone you would call their master, you want to pay respect to them, you call them a gaffer. Then over the centuries, it comes to mean just someone you sort of respect. And then the foreman at work. And then when the movies come around, it becomes, you know, the lead engineer. But it's still used quite commonly in Britain, particularly if you watch football. Soccer, footballers are always talking about their manager as the gaffer, referring to them. Oh, you're the gaffer says blah, 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 blah. I don't know if that gets used as much in the United States still.
Definitely on film and theater sets as well. But I mean, I think one of the pop culture terms that a lot of Americans will also know is Samwise Gamgee in Lord of the Rings. His father is called the gaffer in the Shire.
Oh, is he? Oh, okay. I missed that one.
And then, so the person who reports to the gaffer, a couple of people report to the gaffer, we have on a film set, just to be clear, not in a Hobbiton garden. but the key grip or the grip receive instructions from the gaffer. That can also mean a stagehand and has since like the 1800s. A dolly grip is a person who operates the dolly, the sort of railroad style cart used to capture tracking shots. The best boy is the assistant to the gaffer, particularly when working in electric. And then the origin of this is a little unclear. It might just be from a term for like a favored apprentice or a stagehand. Early call sheets would label the assistant the best boy, and it stuck, and you still get that name regardless of gender sometimes too.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that's a bit more senior than it sounds as well, right? Like showrunner, really, really important role. Super important role. But if you talk about a TV runner, that's someone who fetches the cups of tea in a TV studio in Britain anyway.
By the way, I mentioned a dolly. This goes far beyond film, but do you know why dollies are called dollies?
I don't know why they're called dollies. So a dolly shot is one is what?
It's
on like a trolley, right? A moving
shot.
Yeah,
it's on like a track. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But all dollies, every kind of dolly, like if you're using it to move or if you have a device at work, like in an industrial environment that's called a dolly, all of them go back to various devices that have arms and legs like a child's dolly. Like the first one ever is the dumb dolly, the name of an 18th century washing machine device that had wooden legs to agitate the clothes and two arms you could use to turn it. And from there, it was extended to basically anything else that can move or turn things or has arms or sticks or legs.
Brilliant.
Or round things that look like a head, like a roulette dolly.
Oh, okay. So there's like an anthropomorphizing
yeah.
of all of these different dollies. Nice. And they are so yeah, the dolly shot and the Barbie doll are related. Nice.
While we're on the topic of roles on set, do you know what a crafty does?
No, I have no idea.
They work for Craft Services, which is an on-set food service for the cast and crew, the people responsible for film craft. Do you know what the taco cart is?
Is it some sort of menu?
Well, Craft Services is for food. The taco cart is not for food. It's a grip cart loaded with flags and stands and apple boxes and C-stands, and it's jokingly named for its resemblance to a metal taco holder.
So it's a cart. Taco cart or card?
Mm-hmm. Cart.
Mm-hmm. Cart. Gotcha.
Do you know what a gobo is? This is not a person.
I think we're ultimately getting to the conclusion that I don't know an awful lot about what goes on a film set.
So I got a bunch of these. My mom is actively working on a TV set right now. She's working on 911 Nashville.
Do just explain what your mom does, because it bears repeating.
She is a tailor or sometimes a cutter draper on film sets and movies and TV shows. So like most recently, she worked on a Nicole Kidman show called Scarpetta that's coming out soon. And now she's working on 911 Nashville, which is like it's cops and fire people and whatnot doing dramatic stuff in Nashville played by country music stars. So that's a good one. And then she's done this for movies like The Notebook, Castaway, 42, The Help, things like that. So if you've ever admired a dress or a suit in those films, or even the jersey that Jackie Robinson's character wears in 42, that's her work.
Amazing. Mm. Amazing, Jess.
But she also sent me a list of like obscure set terms to quiz you with.
Okay. Tell me about the gobo then.
A gobo is a stencil or cutout placed in front of a light to cast shadows and shapes.
Oh, okay. Okay. And that rings a bell now.
A lot of these people like don't know exactly where they came from, but the theory on this one is it means like goes before the optics, but that might be like a reverse engineering of it.
Let me mention another reverse engineering that we should also avoid, and that is that's a wrap.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sometimes said that wrap is wind, reel, and print. Right. Which one might want to shout at the end of shooting a film, but except actually you print pretty much every day of production. You don't do it right at the end. It just isn't that, basically. It's from this.
Wrap it up is
probably just from the idea of wrapping up. Yeah. We use it all the time to say the end of something. So that's where that comes from. But I just thought I'd nip that little acronym in the bud.
A cool one with some older technology is the boom, which this isn't just in film and TV, but it's named after a nautical boom on a sailboat.
Oh, that makes sense, because they're both big, long masts of some sort. Big,
might whack you in the face if you don't duck in time.
Yeah, watch it. Yeah, then you put a microphone on the end of it, right?
Do you know what a dead cat or a dead kitten is on a film set?
I know what a dead cat is. It often gets used in sort of political rhetoric to refer to a distraction.
Ah.
A very deliberate distraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I know what you're talking about. But no, this
is... Oh, wait, hold on. Is it the thing that you cover a microphone with?
That's right. I thought you might know this one because it's also just an audio term and you know your audio stuff.
Yeah, I should mention, I've worked in radio most of my career, but my job before I made YouTube videos was here in Germany. I presented on the television. I did business news show. And that's why I'll be a bit more comfortable when we're talking about television than I currently am talking about movies.
Excellent. The reason it's called a dead cat or a dead kitten is because it is furry and because it mutes the wind, essentially dead meaning like dead in the sound.
Well, it also just, it doesn't, it doesn't move, does it? I mean, it's right. Just looks like it's dead. Oh, we used to call it a wind sock more commonly when we didn't want to evoke the idea of, you know, a fallen feline.
Have you heard of the term MOS for filming without sound? And do you know why?
Right. So I know the story about this, and it's based around the idea that a German person got the phrase wrong. Right. So it should be WOS without sound. But supposedly this German fellow says mit out sound, which is a bit odd. But is that, do we think that's true?
It appears to be a recurring industry gag that there were a bunch of German directors who came to Hollywood in the late 1920s. It kind of reminds me of spaghetti Western as a name for Western movies made by Italians.
Is that why they're called spaghetti Western?
Yes. Yes.
Should we talk about Alan Smithy?
Oh, yeah.
You know who he is, right?
An old friend. One of the most famous people in Hollywood. He's done so much.
Yeah, but weirdly, so difficult to track down.
We don't have any pictures of him. Like, what? Who is this guy?
Who is this Alan Smithy? So Alan Smithy is the officially sanctioned name that directors can use. They don't tend to now, but did until like as recently as sort of 2000. If they want to distance themselves from the film that they have directed. So if they don't want to appear on the credits, the name that goes on there is Alan Smithy. And this has been an official policy of the Directors Guild of America since the 1960s, when there was a film called Death of a Gunfighter, which came out in 1969, where one of the actors was clearly really pulling the strings and quite literally calling the shots is what I should have said. He was calling the shots and arranged for the first director to be sacked, brought in another director. The second of those directors has told the story, and he says that by the time, you know, the film was ready, about half of the shots were done by him and about half of the shots were done by the original director, even though the original director had actually done quite a lot more filming. It's just the more sort of important shots have been during his time. But neither director wanted to be associated with the film. And so they went to the Directors Guild of America and discussed what they could do about this. They concluded that they could put a fake name. The first name they went with was Al Smith. Problem with that, really common name, probably people called Al Smith working in Hollywood. So they go for Al Smythe instead. And then they think, oh, there's still a bit. So they settle on Al Smithy. And ever since, that has been the name that has been used by directors that want to distance themselves from their own work. But they're not just allowed to do that off their own back. They have to get the agreement of the Directors Guild of America. They have like a sort of a series of questions. And if the answer to every one of them is no, questions like, were you consulted about every creative decision? If the answer to all of those questions is no, then they are allowed to do this. They're allowed to have Alan Smithy put on the credits instead of their name, but they are never allowed to discuss their experience, particularly the experience of the questionnaire with the Directors Guild of America, and they're not supposed to ever acknowledge that they were the original director of the film. So Alan Smithy has been prolific down the years, although it doesn't tend to happen much these days.
I think the most interesting one of these is probably, it was one of the cuts of David Lynch's Dune, which he had already put his name on for the theatrical release. But when it was edited, I believe for like extended and edited or something like that, someone else is going to know this who is a Dune buff. He didn't like the way it was edited. So he went with the Smithy for the directing credit.
Yeah, they have to really prove that they didn't have sufficient creative control over the finished product. They can't just say, I've done a not a very good job here. And just bail out.
Nowadays, I feel like it's more common to just release the like director's cut. If you have enough clout in the industry, you can release a new theatrical version, but that's pretty rare.
A couple of more things named after people, if I may, but real ones rather than Alan Smithy. Ken Burns, you know about the Ken Burns technique?
I sure do, yeah.
So Ken Burns, American documentarian, spices up a lot of his documentaries by when there's a still image, having either a zoom, a slow zoom, or a slow pan across the image. And doing that is now known as a Ken Burns in the AV industry, the audiovisual, well, particularly the visual industry. And then Foley, speaking of audio, we talk about Foley audio, which is sound effects, basically. Specifically, it's not actually the recording of the thing that you want to have the sound of. It's recording something else to sound like it. You know, instead of having recording someone being punched in the face to get the sound of someone being punched in the face. You smack some leather together or something like that, or you snap a carrot to get the sound of a breaking bone. That's called Foley, and it's named after Jack Foley, who was active in the silent movie era, funnily enough, but the second sound was available, he was all over it and was a leading sound designer for Hollywood. And, you know, such was his prowess, people said that he would make a movie sound better than real life. And to this day, we call sound effects recorded. And put, you know, do you think everyone knows? I'm not sure that almost none of the sounds that you hear in a film, you know, are the sound of the thing that you're watching happening. They're almost all imposed on top because it's very hard to record a set. What you need to focus on getting right is the voices of the actors, right? You need to keep them mic'd up. You can't have mics everywhere picking up the sound of everything else that's going on. So it's almost all superimposed on top. It's almost all Foley, I suppose.
I would assume most people know that, but I also grew up with more than your average exposure to film industry magic and behind the scenes stuff. That's called, what is it? Diegetic and non-diegetic sound? Is that what that's called?
Those are new terms to me. They sound great.
Diegetic is sound that exists within the story world, like the character dialogue, versus sound external to the narrative, like voiceovers and the music score. So that's a different thing entirely, because you can have both as external stuff.
Yeah, but they're extremely good at matching the sound to the action that's going on. It's a whole art form.
We come to expect it, right? Like, because punching someone doesn't actually really make that sound. Like, it's more of a splat, you know? It's what? And then like every sword in a movie goes swing.
Yeah, and there's not a single car in the entirety of America that, so far as I can see, that doesn't screech when you apply the brakes.
The amount of movies where a car like tips sideways as you go around a corner, like that would be a problem.
But we need this stuff. We need this stuff.
My favorite for this is, for at least the like action and chase sequences, is the American TV show The A-Team, which I have seen more than 6 times all the way through. It's one of my favorite shows of all time, right up there with Frasier.
Wait, sorry, you've seen the show 6 times through?
Yeah, I have.
Not just the film. Yeah. No, you mean you've
I've seen the
all
film
all of the episodes?
Times. Yes.
Jess, what's going on? This must be years of your life.
What, have you not watched a show multiple times all the way through?
Yeah, I have, but I mean, how long did the A-Team run for?
5 seasons. 6 yeah. seasons? 5. 5 seasons.
Yeah. And those are long American seasons, right?
Yeah,
not
but
nice,
like
short,
each episode,
6-episode British seasons.
Each episode only has like 15 minutes worth of content in it. Like the opening sequence is like 3 minutes long. I've done the same with Frasier, and that one has 11 seasons.
I've watched all of Seinfeld through at least twice.
There you go.
Seinfeld supposedly popularized the term yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, that's... Well, okay, so I looked into this because I was like, I want to make sure that I am correct on this, and I found...
Yeah, I read it, and I only saw it on one source, and then I was a bit like, maybe it sounds like it should be, I don't know, some sort of Yiddish offshoot to me.
Oddly enough, it seems to be not Yiddish. There are versions of the word yadder dating back to 1825, and they're not Yiddish. They sound Yiddish, right? And I think it's because of the associations there, but most sources point to a Northern English dialect.
But yada, yada, yada leads us quite nicely to Walla Walla. Are you aware of Walla Walla?
Only as a place in Washington.
Aha! No. So Walla is a term, an industry term for background noise, ambient noise, usually okay, in a room, yeah. Sound of background chatter. And Walla Walla is a phrase that people were told to say if they were being a background artist, if they were being an extra, and it needed to look or sound like they were making speech, but you know, you didn't want to distract people with actual words. So it's Walla Walla. And then the other famous example is rhubarb, 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 rhubarb. That's what they're all saying in the background, and the soap operas like EastEnders, they're all just saying it. They're all just rhubarbing.
As a theater kid, I was told to say watermelon, so that makes sense.
Watermelon. Yeah, you know, I'm actually more on board with watermelon, because I was thinking Walla Walla. I see what languages do those look like? And I think watermelon looks like English. The sort of
it
the
has
word,
more movement.
That stuff's going on. Whereas rhubarb. I mean, you don't use
that
bee
looks
that much
to
in
me.
Rhubarb. Yeah. Apple pie.
Macaroni and cheese.
that
might actually work.
Yeah.
Some other film and TV invented terms that we now kind of use either more generally or just to talk about movies. A lot of people will know the term MacGuffin. Are you familiar with this term?
I'm not.
It is a plot device that motivates the characters, but is ultimately unimportant to the plot, like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction or in The Maltese Falcon. We have our MacGuffin object. Alfred Hitchcock loved these, but it was probably coined by screenwriter Angus MacPhail, whose name may have contributed to the structure of the term MacGuffin, which the guff in there, it's supposed to mean like nonsense or unimportant stuff. So your MacGuffin is your thing that sends the characters off on their adventure, but it's really about the, you know, lessons we learned along the way.
Right.
Or the people we shot along the way, things like that. And then, of course, we use MacGyver as an all-purpose verb, too. Do you also use MacGyver as an all-purpose verb?
No, I don't. No, it's not one of my all-purpose. It's a zero-purpose verb.
So if you need to like fix something in your house, but you don't have everything you need to fix it, you like MacGyver a solution it, much like the TV show character who could invent tools and solutions out of chewing gum and duct tape.
Yeah, I only know of MacGyver from, I think, The Simpsons. I think Marge's sisters are fans of MacGyver. I'm not even sure it ran in Britain. Yeah. We call that bodging.
Bodging. Oh, okay. All right. I'm so glad you brought up The Simpsons because there are a couple of words that The Simpsons have popularized. Three or four, as a matter of fact. We have dope, which is like, you know, people will say that now anytime, but that's the obvious one. The other two are cromulent and embiggens.
Embiggen. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So in...
cromulent. Yeah, I can hear Mrs. Krabappel saying that one.
Embiggens? I never heard that word before I moved to Springfield. And Miss Hoover says, I don't know why. It's a perfectly cromulent word.
There we go. That was it. It was Miss Hoover.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Hoover, I glued my head to my shoulder. I have a couple of like kind of funky, like nobody else's theories but mine about this word. So, you know, in context, cromulent seems to mean like acceptable or satisfactory. And the joke, of course, is that neither embiggens nor cromulent at the time were commonly accepted words, though both are now in use and appear in dictionaries thanks to this episode.
Improper dictionaries.
Yeah, right. Well, okay, so embiggens is found perfectly unironically in many places now.
Okay, not okay.
You don't like
this
that
is as
one.
Bad as did we already go into my dislike for winningist? I think embiggen. That's why I don't like winningist, because it sounds like an embiggens style word.
I don't know that we actually talked about it on the podcast. I think we were just chatting about it.
It's because I did a blue sky tweet, whatever you call one of those, getting upset about winningist. So I skeet, okay, because I worked at a sports radio station for 5 years, and we survived 5 years of talking about people winning things without once using the word winningist. And then I see this NPR article and it's in the headline. It's talking about the winningist jockey. And I'm just thinking, well, that looks like a child's made that word up. Is this legit? And then plenty of Americans get in touch to tell me, yes, it is. And why shouldn't it be? And I really struggled to say why it shouldn't be. It just shouldn't.
I always heard it applied to Pat Summitt because I was a UT Vols fan as a child. University of Tennessee Volunteers, their Lady Vols basketball team, made Pat Summitt into one of the winningest coaches of all time. Now, as a result, they're starting a WNBA team in Tennessee called the Summitt, which is very cool. It's a nice nod to her. So, but yeah, winningest was typically applied to it. In my imagination, it sounded perfectly normal because I've been hearing that for a long time.
Why don't I like it?
I get it. I understand why. Because it sounds like embiggens, which now sounds more normal, but is
well, not. I was saying that I think the correct construction, if we're going to use it, should be winniest or winist. Right, that does the most. Ah, no, I'm falling down. This is why I can't explain it, but can we just stop using it anyway?
I think you're correct though, because it gets some weirdness because it has some hybrid elements to it. Like M as a prefix is Germanic, but it's also French, and it also has like, it doesn't appear on big that much, you know, where it's like big. But the reason I like cromulent though is I do think it has some logic to it, even though it is a nonsense word. Like the Latin ending eulentus means full of or with an abundance, like in the word flatulent or flocculent. And then the crom element is meaningless, but you could reverse engineer an etymology if you wanted. Like if you wanted to use like a Welsh word for a stone megalith, you could say that it means, you know, something like crooked or bent, because that's what that root means. So cromulent could imply a crooked smile or something abounding in wry humor.
Now, I know we like to be charitable.
I'm making up here.
That's got to be it. We've got to draw the line somewhere.
We have a lot of these others that came from movies and TV shows, right? Because like we use jump the shark more generally after its use on Happy Days when Fonzie literally jumps over a shark.
It's a phrase that I think is more a la mode now than it ever would have been when Happy Days was on the air.
Right.
Which is funny. It was particularly popular, this phrase, jumping the shark.
It's when a show goes off, takes a sharp downturn in quality. And the note is that on Happy Days, this episode in which he jumps over the shark was the first of many terrible episodes that made the show tank in quality and eventually go off the air. Another one, red shirt, which we see in movies from Star Trek, right? Or it's generally on TV. A crew member or a character wearing a red shirt in a lot of TV shows is more likely to die than others because that was standard on Star Trek.
Is that because it was they low-ranking officers on board the Starship Enterprise?
Right. A character who's like introduced just to die. So they don't have to be wearing a red shirt, like somebody who just shows up and then dies by the end of the episode or within the first few minutes could be termed a red shirt, whether they're wearing one or not. But a lot of shows will also put those people in red shirts as a nod to Star Trek.
Very good. Yeah, you get these little sort of in jokes.
Some that are in like popular lexicon is like catfishing is from the TV show Catfish, which is about couples who have formed online relationships but have never met in person. And catfishing is using a false online identity to deceive someone into a relationship.
So how did they come up with the name of the series?
It takes its title from an almost certainly apocryphal anecdote about fishermen putting a catfish in the tank with a shipment of live cod to keep the cod active in transit and tastier at the table.
Let's see. Okay. All right. This is one of those ones like bucket list, right? People for some reason don't believe that the phrase bucket list when people talk about it. They are referencing the film Bucket List, whether they like it or not.
I hate talking about this one because people get so mad. They get so upset about it. The term kicking the bucket is much older. I think that's the problem, is like people would make lists of things to do before I kick the bucket. But people are certain that they had like a diary that said bucket list, and that it's like this term, even though it was widely known and widely used, never made its way into any written recording before 2006.
And for some reason, no one can find their diary with bucket list written in it.
Right. People are like, no, I'm certain. I use this all the time. People said it. They just never wrote it down, which like the more you learn about these kinds of things, the more you realize that's wildly unlikely. And like even the OED is like, yes, it is from the film The Bucket List.
It's a Mandela effect, isn't it? It's a collective misremembering.
Another one that I mentioned on Blue Sky the other day is the term like we're toast. Like we're toast or he's toast. We had idioms like served on toast or like to serve someone on toast as to like beat them up or whatever back to the 1800s. But similar like you're toast, the just that construction is first found in Ghostbusters.
Really?
Yeah. Like Bill Murray ad-libbed, even in the script, the line was, I'm going to turn this guy into toast, which that's not unheard of either. But Bill Murray ad-libbed, this chick is toast, and from that scripted line. And now we say we're toast, and it's everywhere.
So Bill Murray getting the recognition he deserves in the dictionaries, hopefully.
He deserves it. I love it. Yeah. I'd say there are some others like dark side. We'll use that generally. Red pill and blue pill. Those have gone off on their own horrible adventure in some ways.
Yeah.
And then ception. People use the ending ception as a weird rebracketing to mean like nested because of the film Inception, like to do something within something else, like the movie Inception when they infiltrate other people's dreams and dreams within dreams. The real word for this is called recursion. It's in like computer programming and a lot of other disciplines, but it's also in linguistics. In linguistics, recursion is the capacity to embed linguistic structures within other structures. So in the phrase, Rob thinks Jess is silly is itself a sentence embedded recursively into the sentence Rob thinks. And the cool thing here is you could go on basically infinitely, like Rob said that Jess said that Henry thought that Marjorie said, and like follow the verb with these endless strings of self-contained sentences.
And what's this got to do with Inception?
In the film Inception, it's like multiple layers. It what they are doing is called recursion, and people are using the endingception because of the name of the movie to describe recursion.
Things within things within things within things.
Exactly. Gotcha. But Inception means a beginning, of course.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean that at all.
Can I bring in a couple of sort of transatlantic differences from TV sets?
Let's do it.
Do you know what a Chiron is?
I do. I would say it's not that common of a term.
Yeah, I don't think most people do know what one is necessarily. But you know when, it's also sometimes known as a lower third, but you know, any graphic that appears on top of, say on the news is covered in blooming chirons, the thing at the bottom that says, you know, the name of the person speaking or the little or the new stuff, they're all called chirons, and they're named specifically after the Chiron Corporation, which was a leading producer of TV graphics in the early days. But they're not called chirons in Britain. They're called Astons. And that's because we had a company called Aston Broadcast Systems that provided all of ours.
So, excellent.
Yeah. So when I came to Germany and started working in television and people were using the word Chiron, I was thinking, what's going on here? Because actually the American industry had influenced the newsroom I was in more than the British one. And another one, and I now find myself saying this, I use the word teleprompter instead of auto cue, which is what it's typically called in Britain, because because the company that tended to provide the teleprompter, and the device is called a teleprompter, right? The company that invented the teleprompter was called Teleprompter. And yeah, the company that provided them to the likes of the BBC in Britain was called AutoCue. So they've got different names. But the original AutoCue, the original teleprompter, it worked with paper, right? It had a roll of, of paper that would revolve, and it would be just above the camera. So people would look like they're sort of looking at the camera, but not quite. And it would be strangely sort of uncanny as they read through. Now, actually, I've got one here. I don't know if everyone knows how one of these things works. This is the one I use for my videos.
Oh, right? Cool.
This is obviously a mini one. And I pop a little my phone here. Hold on, give me a moment.
I love this demo.
My phone screen is reflected because all it is a piece of angled glass in front of where the camera is, which is at the back of there. And it's remarkably clever. It's very similar to a magic trick or when they claim that they're doing like a hologram on a theatre stage. What they're actually doing is they've just got a slanted piece of glass at 45 degrees, and whatever they're showing is actually happening at a 90 degree angle below the stage. That's how teleprompters or auto cues, as they're called in Britain, work.
Excellent. That's C-U-E, right?
C-U-E. Yeah. And to cue someone in television is to tell them to start.
Allegedly from the Latin quando, right?
Meaning when. What, when? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, okay. Say when.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's very similar to prompt. You know, to prompt is to tell someone when to do something.
Excellent.
Cut. Check the gate. Is that a wrap, Jess?
I think that is a wrap. We won't leave you on a cliffhanger. I think we've covered a good amount of terms here. We could probably do more of this in the future and then connect to theater. We've had a couple of people ask for theater terms, and there's some cool overlap here. So I look forward to talking more about this in the future. And in the meantime, if you're just finding us for the first time, please hit that subscribe button. We'd be so excited for you to subscribe.
You know, not if you're just finding us for the first time. I've been looking at the data. Most of the people watching our videos are not subscribed. You've watched loads of them and you haven't subscribed. Hit subscribe. It does. I mean, it basically, yes, it gives us a little boost, and that's nice, but it doesn't really come at any cost to you. Hit subscribe. Mm-hmm. But if you do, for whatever reason, wish to throw some pennies our way, you can also sign up as one of our members. If you come to this YouTube video, if you're listening, you go to our YouTube channel, you can find it. Obviously, it's youtube.com/ at Words Unraveled. But if you're already watching this on YouTube, just have a look below this video and there's a join button with a variety of different levels where you can get a variety of different perks, including having your name in a few seconds appear on the screen.
We're also planning some other things, you know, but pending for our members in the coming weeks and months. So stay tuned.
Take care.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.